welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet James Allen Hall. James Allen Hall teaches at Washington College in Maryland. He is the author of Now You're the Enemy, published by the University of Arkansas Press, and winner of the Lambda Literary Award in Poetry. His new manuscript, entitled Romantic Comedy, is currently under consideration for publication. Hi, James. How are you?
I'm fabulous, Jan. How are you?
I'm also fabulous, and I'm really happy to see you. It's been too long since you've been on Prosody, and so happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be back.
Okay, so you're going to start with some poems from Now You're the Enemy.
That's right. There's a few portrait poems in the book. This one is called Family Portrait. It's one of a few family portraits. If I could turn the photograph, bring my mother's face to the bright eye of myth, my unflinching lens, you'd see she's mouthing the words, take the picture already. You'd see my father's lust, his loathing, molding her body into some four-legged photogenic thing, whipped and adored. You'd see my mother emerging from the ghost world, limb by limb, carrying on her bowed shoulders Eros and his sadomasochistic twin. In the dim, violated light, she's marked by a man who can't let any part of her go. In the light my father makes in the dark, I was mothered into art. This next poem is, owes a debt to the movie Rosemary's Baby. And the dialogue and sort of the stuff that happens in the poem all come from the movie, which was directed by Roman Polanski. This is Portrait of My Mother as Rosemary Woodhouse. My mother dreams she's adrift on the Adriatic Sea, naked, elderly men and women lounging all around her. Blue waves slap against her thigh and stones fall from unspeakable cliffs. I am dropped into her, boulder after boulder of me, until I am safely drowned inside her. In the morning, Manhattan never looks so peaceful. I dreamed someone was raping me, she says, shaking her honey blonde hair. Thanks, her husband jokes, displaying newly manicured nails. It was kind of fun in a necrophile sort of way. My mother marks my due date on her kitchen calendar. The red circles stare back matter-of-factly. These are horrible times. A month later, my mother accuses Dr. Saperstein of poisoning me. My mother fears her life has ended. Her life has grown beyond her. Her life will sprout a hybrid black bloom. She packs her one bag, runs from her husband's house to the refuge of Dr. Hill, her first physician. All around her, women slow to a blue wintry blur. A flurry of women lay their hands on her stomach, chanting, "Pain is a sign, something awful's happening." My mother does not heed this loose-tongued omen. She stops in at Vidal Sassoon, steps out reborn. The first modern woman, her jawline fixed parallel to the city's trash-strewn streets. She envisions such elegant escape. Dr. Hill's surprised to see his former patient. Imbued with the power to overlook narrative gaps, he does not flinch at her story. He's the promise of good in a darkening nation. My mother prays God will bless Dr. Hill. But the story of belief runs parallel to the story of betrayal. My drugged mother gives birth to a living death. After weeks of hearing my crying, my mother dismantles the false wall with the plastic crucifix. She explores the passage from the dream world to the one whose reign I herald, the world of hoarded women. Entering with a knife, she emits a battle cry and spits in her husband's face. Her wrath slides down his cheek. When I begin to cry again, she wants to hold me. She drops the knife. The dream of the knife becomes the story of a generation full of black bassinets. In the story, all along, the naked bodies were real. Covens are a fact of America, and I am the thing most coveted. The proof, my mother loved each of her ruinous children well. This next poem owes a debt to a painting by George Daw, who was an abolitionist. He painted this painting in 1809 to 1810. It's a depiction of a slave being made to wrestle a buffalo while people watch. And the title of the painting is "A Negro Overpowering a Buffalo, a Fact Which Occurred in America, 1809." And my poem is called "A Fact Which Occurred in America." In the fifth grade, when we came finally to the Civil War, the teacher kept saying, "We lost. We lost." His eyes a shadowy grief under his favorite painting, a laminated Daw reproduction subtitled "A Fact Which Occurred in America," a black man wrestling a buffalo to the ground. The ground becomes his grave. I am the buffalo. In the painting of the buffalo rolling his eye to size up the man who will never be strong enough to wrestle his way out of the definition of black, I am trying to say, we are metaphors for each other. Please, don't kill me. The man is black. But so is the buffalo, so is the sky, and so is the heart which keeps this fact holy. In the painting, I am the buffalo because I want to be loved by pure physicality, a man with broad hips and broader anger and a yoke around his neck which has not broken him yet. In the painting about a buffalo's last breath, I am the dust matted on the lips. Kiss me, keep me in your mouth. Don't let me dissolve into fact. In the painting about a boy who writes, I am sorry we lost the Civil War 50 times on the blackboard after school in his deserted fifth grade class. I am the bone white chalk. I have always wanted to be someone's defiled good buffalo. In the painting, the man tells the buffalo, play dead. I'll get you out of this. In the defiled fifth grade teacher's laminated copy of the painting, I am the racing pulse of the boy getting his revenge when the teacher isn't looking. I am the time after we learned about the heroic Civil War on the playground when Datreon caught me alone in the maze of trees and held me down with one hand, kissed me with his tongue, licking my lip first, smoothing it for his, my first kiss, on the ground, the leaves spreading under us black and wet. Deep in the animal wrestled down part of me, the boy was bent like a tree over a maze, scribbling a hyphenated name in tiny scrawl, in black ink, on a piece of paper, trying all hour during language arts to get back to the maze. When the teacher snatches up the paper, his eyes widening at the darker revolt. In the punishment, I was the blackboard, my body lashed by loss and sorrow. I was the buffalo. I wanted to lose the war. I wanted to stay black. The filmy white chalk, a sickness stretched over my skin. In that America, I am always betraying the master.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet James Allen Hall. He's reading some poems from his book, Now You're the Enemy. In that last poem is so strong, and it's one of my favorite poems, but I always feel the shifting metaphors in that poem. You know, the speaker saying, I was the buffalo, I was the blackboard, it keeps moving. And I know that it's hard to have shifting metaphors in a poem and make it work. Can you talk about that element of craft in your work? Because it shows up in other poems also.
Yeah, I mean, I love metaphor for what it can do. It can free us, right? We can transform. It's so optimistic, metaphor. It says we don't have to stay what we are. And of course, we never do. The tragedy, I think, of some people is that they try to stay what they are. I think what I do in that poem is to use the sort of unity of place. So it's just the setting up the rules. We've got a painting. We've got a blackboard. We've got a classroom. And so we can only choose those elements from the scene. So I'm not, you know, if you think about like the unity of time, place, and action, it's that time of unity of place that I'm shifting around to. But I can never get out of the cage of the classroom, you know?
Yeah.
The teacher becomes a master, and then, you know, now it's a different narrative, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get confused when you... when you're writing and you're shifting metaphors, you know, saying, well, can this I be this? Can this I be this? What happens if this I becomes this? And I guess that's part of working out the poem, but maybe in revision. But I don't know. I think I would get confused with, you know, if this I becomes this, what does that mean?
You know what I mean? Yeah, no, in a story, whenever, you know, I'm looking at a story or writing a story, I want to know, besides the I that I am telling the story, who am I in the story? You know, am I the buffalo? Am I the audience member? Am I the teacher? Am I Datreon? You know, where does my identification desire live? In order to uncover something new about myself or something new about the situation, some epiphany, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, poems that shift too much, you know, or have too much rupture or rapture, you know, that's a different problem. But what a nice problem to have.
Yeah, too much rapture. That sounds good.
Yeah, I'm all right with that. But, you know, there's got to be some pattern, something that grounds the poem besides just the linguistic I, you know? I have friends who write poems where the I is different. It's a different I.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I read a poem with I's down the page, I always think it's the same I, you know?
Yeah. Anything could happen.
Anything could happen, isn't it? And that's what you want from a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel with your poems. I've read your book many, many times and studied your book. But even when I open it now, I think anything could happen, which I love.
I mean, it's fun to go back to, now, you know, I've been away from this book for a little while, and to go back to it, I don't read my own book, you know what I mean? Like, there's...
Every day you read your book.
Yeah, me on my couch, like, oh, look what I've done, and my little fake Irish accent. I'm so pleased with myself, not at all, but, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, look at that thing I used to do. I don't do that anymore, or in the same way, and, you know... It's fascinating to me. I'm a different person or a different poet.
Yeah.
But, you know, then I went back recently to my undergraduate college. A poet and teacher had me back, and she showed me a poem in a literary magazine I published, you know, in the school magazine. And it was me. I mean, I recognized myself there, and I was like, holy moly, yeah. How did that happen?
Yeah, certain things are set in motion, and you may not know it, but it's going there.
And I remembered the things that she gave me for the poem too, you know, like, oh, you could say this, you could do this. And I remembered each part of that, you know.
Wow.
Because it was just a moment of aspiration, like, oh my god, oh, I can make this leap, I could do this thing over here.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we get stuck in the same leaps or the same choices linguistically, I think, that we die as poets.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. I'm sort of going to shift from my mom to my dad. This is a poem about my father in the hospital. My father's time. My life is 3 minutes slow, a stalled clock on the dim cinder block wall in the waiting room. My father is doled out in increments along with the doctor's pronouncements. neural complications, the tectonic crash of interhemispheric hemorrhage. My father lives beneath these words, more still than sculpture. A thin tube runs from his skull into a translucent bag. I apply Blistex to his cracked lips. His chalky tongue laps up the light coat of moisture. Proof, his body is gone, automatic. The few times my father told me he loved me, I didn't say it back. I wanted to hurt him. I sit on his bed, bring my face to his, and when I say it, nothing returns to me except his breath. I want to hurt my father. I know pain can lead his way back to living. The rash around his wrists tells me my father's body has chained him deep in his flesh. The blood drips from a world I can't know, where nothing is cemented and said. There the dry earth holds the demolished, as if the wreck could still be inhabited. We could still be afflicted with time. My father did come back, and the body was changed. And now I'll never tell my father, because the words have changed. They died. They didn't come back, not even crippled, not even blinking, twice for yes, once for no, three times for I need you. Please write this down. The first line of this poem is also the title of the poem. My father calls to say the walls are on fire, by which he means nothing as extraordinary as daybreak. And I say, Dad, what time is it there? Because he can still read digital hours. And he says, you're on fire. All of us smoke. Look out your window. But there's only the magnolia arming itself against Houston, oil refineries pluming smoke into the air, and my neighbor starting her gray Impala, driver's side door open, one leg still dangling outside as she reverses, her full skirt brushing lilac against the ground. I've never lived anywhere so insistent on pastel, on hair tailored into a tulip's bloom. I don't see anything, Dad, I say, sighing, turning on the television to hear the air purity report. It's only dark in your eyes, he says, which is what he'd always say when I was a kid, begging him to switch on the light after his ghost story. And he'd laugh, saying the light was already on. And how many times did I believe him, rubbing my eyes until stars appeared? But now I can't get to him, lead him back to bed, saying, I made it all up. I'm sorry. I made up that whole story. It's 8 a.m. It's too early for this. Please stop being sick. My father insists danger, but I'm not listening. The television is on, and some god made a fist and punched through the World Trade Center, ordered the city below to run faster. We're not all of us going to survive. Without knowing I'm talking at all, I'm saying, no, Dad, repeating it, because a god made me too. And sometimes denial is my only religion, as in he isn't getting worse. My father isn't deranged. He's still a citizen, the man who told tall tales in order to prepare me for this world, hazed in smoke, where the tower was always made of a burnt falling, the brain always a matter of surrender, and memory a tool that demolishes, since it wants things whole. My father still telling stories with a flashlight under his chin, his face reddened, eyes like caves, his hair already receding.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet James Allen Hall, reading some new poems. I wanted to ask you about the idea of portrait in a poem. And I've heard you talk about portrait a little bit, but in some of your titles you have portrait of my mother as, portrait of my father as. But I also have heard you tell a story about when you were learning to write. Maybe you can tell that story about a woman, a visual art piece where a woman was moving from frame to frame in terms of portraiture.
Sure. I think the portrait allows me to point at, this is a snapshot. This is one moment in time, and another portrait will show something else. So when I was learning to write at Stetson University, I had this teacher who I love. I just adore her. Her name is Terry Wittick, and she's a poet, wonderful wordsmith. And she gave us this assignment. We had to do a close reading of a poem in a contemporary journal, and I chose this poem in the Beloit Poetry Journal. And the speaker of the poem was looking at these two different pieces of art. They both had a body of water in them, and the speaker dove into one lake, let's say, and then rose up into the other painting and was in the frame of it and totally transformed those two different things and unified them at the same time. And man, it just felt like magic to me. I wanted to do that. So I learned that, for me anyway, poetry was a way of seeing the world, of lensing, of creating distance or collapsing distance between the reader and the writer, between the writer and the subject matter, whatever it is. Those sort of strategies of intimacy are still, I'm under that spell, I think.
So when you write a portrait poem, are you trying to fix something in time, or?
I think I'm trying to say, let's put this frame on this thing and see what happens and see what I know, what I can learn. Mm-hmm. But I want to point at the frame and say that frame is unstable. We can put a different frame on this, you know? So in the book, I have this poem of Manet paintings, and it's like eight different Manet paintings. One of the first ones allowed me to sort of say something like, why is the artist always painting this subject this way? Why does she always have to be sad and terrible? Why can't she just be happy sometimes? Where's her joy? Why is this artist doing this messed up stuff, right? Like, his frame is on the subject, and shouldn't the subject get to be freed of the artist at some point, you know? So it allowed me to write my mother's story without writing proscriptively, I guess. And also to say, you know, I'm writing my obsession with my mother, not my mother, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
A very important distinction.
Really important distinction, because, you know, I don't want to, my mother is not cemented by what I've said, you know?
Or defined in any ways.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. No.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, we have time for some more.
Okay. So another frame. This is a new poem, but I love this. So I guess in my spare time, I like to, when I'm feeling really down, I like to watch this video on YouTube of Anita Bryant getting a pie in the face. Anita Bryant is a virulently anti-gay. First, she was a beauty queen and then a singer and then a spokesperson for this campaign in the 70s called Save the Children. So she makes an appearance in this next poem. It's called On Dark Days, I Imagine My Parents' Wedding Video. I like how my mother, Anita Bryant, waves to the cameras without looking at the men behind them, keeping her chastity intact, unassailable as her perfect coiffure, dark as coffee, the white saucer of her powdered face. I like the news conference, its swirling choreography of men and microphones, always on the periphery, a vulgar joke about to declare itself in the throng of serious journalists, one of whom is a pretender, my father. I like the irony of Save the Children blared on a banner behind her. I am waiting to be born, a child unlike others, one my mother would not save. I like the reporter's blazers, plaid, unbuttoned, like the man approaching Anita's dais from her right. I love my mother, innocent like this, smiling back at some softball political question. I like the hiding in plain sight that the man and the Anita are doing before they become my parents. I like knowing more than the camera or my mother. I am like my father, the spy who will be arrested. And here is the moment lifting the veil now, their kiss. The man slaps a pie square in Anita's face. She hadn't seen him coming, the man the others call His Highness in the newspaper room. She was saying, what they want is the right to propose to our children that theirs is an acceptable life. Then it's time for cake. I like his hate, which hates her back. She is my mother because she says, at least it's a fruit pie, then begins to sob. I like watching her beauty. He dissolves in revolt against its tyranny. 30 years ago now, my father dead, buried, and no one remembers his name. I'll close with a poem called Prophecy. This is this poem has a figure in it named Adam Walsh, who was a boy abducted in 1981 from a mall in Florida. I also grew up in Florida. And every time we left the house, my mother would say this thing that sort of prompted this poem, Prophecy. Remember, my mother said, they found Adam Walsh in pieces, buttoning my jacket, kissing my cheek, sending me off to school directly across the dead end road. Our street, severed by woods, I couldn't shake loose its prophecy. In school, we play hangman. On the chalkboard, a neck in a noose, a word underneath in dashes, letters looming from the fog, filling in the blanks until one grinning boy hangs another.
The poetry of James Allen Hall. Thank you so much. It was so great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.